Today at Reader's Corner, former BBC China correspondent Adam Brooks, author of the new novel, Night Heron.
I went in with modest hopes that I could write something a bit more engaging and had a little bit more depth than some of the thrillers that we've seen about China in recent years have had. What I was trying to do here in the book is try to bring to life a little bit the degree to which contemporary China is turning into a surveillance state. It's not just the internet and social media. It is surveillance cameras, it's cell phone tracking. It's really very, very pervasive. The surveillance in China is very high-tech and very, very frightening.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In a brutal labor camp in a remote part of Western China, a man imprisoned for 20 years plots his escape. In Beijing, an ambitious foreign correspondent stumbles into a web of secrets that are more valuable than he ever dreams. And in London, British intelligence agents, who bear little resemblance to James Bond, scramble to pursue a surprising and intriguing lead. This is just a sampling of the twists and turns found on the pages of Adam Brooks' riveting debut novel, Night Heron. The book is fiction, but the issues it explores and the settings it evokes couldn't be more real or relevant. In Night Heron, Mr. Brooks transports us to the bustling streets of Beijing, where surveillance cameras hang from buildings, and to the back corridors of the city, where crime and espionage thrive. The book is a definite page-turner, but it is also an insightful look at China today and raises timely questions about what happens when governments and industry are complicit in gathering and sharing secret information. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Adam Brooks. For many years he worked as a foreign correspondent reporting for the BBC from China, Indonesia, and the United States. Fans of Night Heron, and I count myself among them, will be pleased to hear that a sequel to the book, titled Spy Games, will be out in July. Mr. Brooks joins us by phone for this interview. Adam Brooks, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks very much for having me.
Adam, do I have that right that you are still with the BBC?
I'm technically a freelancer now. I left behind after more than 20 years my full-time correspondent status because I thought if I was going to try and do fiction writing, I should probably, you know, give it my all.
Absolutely.
I've discovered I'm not a very fast writer, and so I need sort of time and space to do it. So I went freelance from the BBC, and I'm still doing some journalism, but I'm attempting to make a go of full-time fiction writing, which at my time in life is, one might say, a high-risk activity.
Yeah. Well, as I was saying before we started this show, I'm so impressed with this book, and I'm delighted to hear you're working on the follow-up, and also delighted that this book is probably going to see its way to some screen. And I must say I'm feeling a little smug about this, Adam, because when I picked up your book, there were no reviews out there. I read the jacket. I looked at your bio and I thought, this guy spent time in China. I'm going to learn something about China. And that's my requirement for fiction. I want to be entertained, but I want to learn something. And now I pick up the reviews and like the Telegraph says, the best British spy novel in ages. The LA Times says Adam Brooks has written an outstanding first novel about a British scheme to steal state secrets. The modern spy thriller has turned a new page with Adam Brooks. Did you have any idea when you...
Keep going.
You like this, huh?
I always enjoy it.
Right. Did you have any idea when you were getting into this that you would strike such a claim on the very first one?
No, I didn't. Of course I didn't, no. I mean, I went in with modest hopes that I could write something about China that was a bit more engaging and had a little bit more depth than perhaps some of the thrillers that we've seen about China in recent years have had. I don't want to disparage other people's work, but China's not an easy place to get to grips with. And I think readers find it quite hard as well, because the story of China is rather alien. We don't understand it very well. Chinese names are very, very hard to follow. Place names are hard to follow. People's personal names are hard to follow. It's difficult to keep characters differentiated. People don't have many terms of reference when you think about contemporary China. So So I thought that, you know, my selling point for a first novel might be that after spending many years in China, I was there for a total of about 8 years, and I still go back quite a bit, might be to try and take some of the detail and the color and the texture of China and try to draw the reader in the thriller context, in the commercial fiction context. And so far, so good. I think it seems to be working reasonably well. And I've tried very hard to keep you oriented as a reader so that you don't get confused, particularly with Chinese names, which are so hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, you remind me of Churchill's famous quote about Russia. I think he said it's a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. And in a sense, as I read about China, and that's why I picked up your book, I'm as confused as the next person, unless, of course, you've traveled there and spent 8 years there as you have.
But even so, you know, I mean, I spent more than 7 years as a reporter working in Beijing, and I studied Chinese at university. I studied over there as a student. And there are still great big blocks of China that we don't know about. So the most sort of significant and important bits of the Chinese government are still very, very close to us. We don't really understand a great deal about the way that the Communist Party works at high level. I was talking to a senior American diplomat right here in Washington, D.C., not so long ago, and he admitted to me quite frankly that even in the higher reaches of the U.S. government, they're still not clear how China's new president actually became China's new president, how Xi Jinping came to power, what all that political drama was and how it played out. We still don't really know, even with everything that we have today, all our networks, our computers, the internet, the massive espionage and surveillance effort directed against China. There are still big parts of that country that are a black box to us.
Well, I'm very careful in interviews like this not to give away the denouement of the book, but I do think it's important to lay out the basics of the plot. And maybe what you could do is at least describe two of the central characters, Philip Mangan, the British spy, so to speak, and, of course, Peanut, the Chinese man who I referred to at the outset. Give us a flavor for what's going on here in their lives and how they come to meet up with each other.
So Philip Mangan is a foreign correspondent based in Beijing, and he writes for a British newspaper, and he works for a little television news agency. He's a freelance correspondent, and he's sort of restless, and he's sort of impetuous, and he suffers from a state of mind that many journalists do, in my experience, which is that even as he covers great events, he feels that he sits on the margins, and he feels a permanent gnawing sense of frustration at this. And that sense is sort of brought out in him, particularly in China, because covering China is so hard for a journalist. You're stopped at every turn. And that restlessness and a certain amount of vanity on his part lead him to start making some rather poor decisions. And one day when a man turns up on his doorstep offering him secrets, he allows himself to get drawn into espionage in a way that a journalist simply never should.
And this is something you've learned personally, because I believe you have actually had this happen to you, but you had a different result.
It's actually not that uncommon for foreign correspondents. In China, it's happened to a number of people, and I was one of them. A guy did turn up at my office in Beijing, at the BBC Beijing Bureau, when I was a correspondent there. And he sat down in the bureau, and he opened his briefcase, and he pulled out a sheaf of secret documents and tried to get me to take them. And he was very persistent over a couple of weeks. He kept coming back and calling me up and telling me that he wanted to pass secret information to the British government, and I should be his go-between, and all this sort of stuff. Now, I don't think he was for real. I think it was a provocation. I think he had been sent by somebody to see if he could sort of flush me out, to see if I was really a journalist or whether I was really an intelligence officer working undercover as a journalist. And that kind of provocation isn't that uncommon. I told him to get lost. I sent him packing. I sent him on his way. But yes, his story sort of stayed with me, and that incident kind of morphed over the years into the story that became Night Heron.
So Mangan assumes that his apartment is bugged and that his mobile phone's being tracked in a number of incidents in the book. Is that the way you felt when you were over there?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It sounds, I mean, it sounds odd, and you can't quite believe it yourself at the time. It sort of sounds silly. But when you've been in China for a little while, and particularly if, as a reporter, you are trying to cover those stories that the Chinese government doesn't want you to cover, if you are talking to dissidents, if you're talking to protesters, if you're talking to underground religious movements, if you're talking to people who are trying to organize in factories and workplaces, that kind of thing, you can expect that the Chinese government will move to either stop you doing that reporting, or they'll monitor you to see who you're talking to. And this sometimes, it kind of went in waves. It wasn't all the time. But at times of political tension in China, foreign correspondents expect to find themselves under quite tight surveillance. You can be followed. Your mobile phone will be tracked. Your phone will be tapped. You can even anticipate, certainly among kind of the larger, more serious organizations, can anticipate that their conversations aren't being held in private. And that's part of what, you know, it kind of inducing that psychology of slight paranoia in the journalist is exactly what the Chinese government seeks to do, because then the journalist starts self-censoring. And that's what the government wants them to do.
You're listening to Adam Brooks, former BBC correspondent who has written the novel Night Heron, which we're discussing today. So let's talk about the relationship that the correspondent has to those folks all the way back thousands of miles away in BBC headquarters. You're trying to deal with them. I assume that's a different relationship when it comes to what they think you should be covering and what you think should be covering than if you were sitting over in Germany, where London's going to know a lot about Germany. But again, back to the mystery part of China. Is it a more difficult and complex relationship?
That's a great question. Actually, it was great being in China because the people on the desk in London, even your most kind of astute editors, really didn't know very much about China. So they could never gainsay you. They were never able to turn around and tell you that you were wrong or you were doing the wrong thing or you should be covering something else because they really didn't have a clue. So you had enormous latitude as a reporter in China to tell the desk back in London what it is they needed to be paying attention to, and they just sort of nodded meekly and accepted your decisions. In sharp contrast to being a correspondent in the United States, for example, being based in Washington, D.C., where everybody in London assumes that they know everything about the United States. And not only that, they wake up 5 hours ahead of you. So when you wake up of a morning as a reporter based in Washington, your desk in London has already been at work for about 3 hours, and they have formulated all these crazy ideas about what you should be covering during your day. And so you're constantly fighting off the preconceptions of people who think they know much more about America and who than they actually do.
Right.
That sounds a bit slanderous, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. The BBC is not a bad desk to work for in general. They're pretty smart.
Well, Philip Mangan also is assisted by a Chinese national, a very well-connected woman named Ting. Tell us a little about her, and more importantly, how important are assistants like this to journalists? It sounds like a dangerous occupation if you're Chinese and you're helping somebody out who they don't trust anyway.
It's one of the hardest parts of covering China is exactly this. In theory, according to Chinese law, Chinese nationals are not permitted to work for foreign news organizations. It's still against the law to do so. Back in the day, when I was a reporter back in the sort of late 1990s, I would actually be assigned an assistant by the Chinese government. So they were actually employed by the Chinese government, and not only were they there to assist me and to translate for me if I needed it and to manage my office, they, of course, were also there to report back on me to the Chinese authorities. That system still exists, but it's loosened up quite a lot. However, Chinese nationals who work for foreign correspondents, for an American newspaper or for, you know, a foreign broadcaster or whoever, as translators, as researchers, even as drivers, find themselves in a very, very difficult position, and it can be quite dangerous for them. There have been a number of cases, without going into details, where Chinese nationals have got into very hot water with the Chinese Communist Party and Chinese security because they've assisted foreign journalists on stories that are deemed critical or a threat to national security. And they have been taken away and given a very, very bad time indeed. So that's one of the hardest parts of reporting in China, is gaining that local knowledge that you really need by employing local researchers and local fixers. It's a very, very difficult dance that foreign reporters have to do.
And another way that reporters can get that information is through an online hacker like the one in your novel named Tree Frog. How common is it for there to be real-life tree frogs out there working with foreign correspondents?
In my experience, not so much. But increasingly, you're starting to see a very interesting set of interactions between hackers, social media people, and journalists. I mean, it's happening all over the world, but it's happening in a much more tense and acute way in China. The Chinese government tries very, very hard to control information on the internet. It employs tens of thousands of people as monitors of the Chinese internet. It has a huge firewall around the Chinese internet so that foreign websites aren't given access to China necessarily. And whenever a discussion starts on the Chinese internet that the Chinese government doesn't like, they'll simply delete it. They'll delete web postings, they'll delete Twitter postings, and they will run algorithms that just take search terms off the internet altogether in China. So there's a real cat and mouse game going on between the social media activists in China and journalists. Say something happens in a little town in West China, there's a protest or there's an arrest or something's gone on that's of interest to a foreign journalist. Somebody in that little town will tweet it on one of China's huge social media platforms, like Weibo, for example. And within minutes, literally within minutes, the Chinese internet censors will start taking those tweets down. But by that time, it's being retweeted and resent around China. So there then follows a cat-and-mouse game each time one of these stories pops up. And the foreign journalists are always on the lookout for those little flurries of social media activity that they can get hold of. And some of these media activists are now getting very, very good at plucking out those little bits of information, removing them from the Chinese internet and making them available to the rest of the world. But again, it's a very strange and very tense sort of social media situation that you've got there right now.
And perhaps a more old-fashioned approach to this kind of surveillance are the cameras. And I didn't give you a chance to talk a little bit about Peanut, but when Peanut returns from rural China, he's really, by the time he gets to Tiananmen Square, is freaked out by these surveillance cameras that are watching everything people do. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about Peanut and whether or not those cameras are as pervasive in China, in Beijing, let's say, or are they just in Tiananmen Square for obvious reasons?
So Peanut is my second protagonist, and he's a middle-aged Chinese man. He's this sharp-eyed, rather ruthless, rather rotund ex-aerospace engineer who has found himself in prison. But he's also lived this parallel life. He has been caught up in espionage before, and he's now on the run, and he is trying to build himself a new life, and he is trying to get back in touch with British intelligence one last time. And because he's been in a labor camp for 20 years, he hasn't seen the transformation that China has undergone. And he finds himself dropped into this new world that he simply doesn't understand. He doesn't know how to use a cell phone. He doesn't understand that there are surveillance cameras all over the center of Beijing. He doesn't understand that phones can be monitored, that they can be tracked. He doesn't understand that there are surveillance cameras in every metro station watching you as you go down the escalators and as you get on and off the train. He doesn't know any of this, but he must now try and survive in China's surveillance state in order to see through this last espionage scheme that he has. And what I was trying to do here in the book is try to bring to life a little bit the degree to which contemporary China is turning into a surveillance state. It's not just the internet and social media. It is surveillance cameras. It's cell phone tracking. It's little old ladies on street corners. It's the monitoring of your laptop. It's people coming into your hotel room and going through your stuff. It's really very, very pervasive. The surveillance in China is very high-tech and very, very frightening. And it's hard to sort of get your arms around and quite believe that it's happening, but it is there.
I assume even more so today than when you were over there as a BBC correspondent?
Yeah, the technology gets better and better. And the Chinese are across the technology, and much of the technology has now worked its way into sort of everyday life. If you go to China today as an American, you should probably not take your own laptop with you. You should certainly not take your laptop if it has any proprietary information on it at all about your business. You probably shouldn't take it if it's got sort of log-on information or software for a proprietary computer network. You certainly shouldn't take it if you're a government employee. In fact, I think it's illegal to take your laptop to China now if you're a government employee. People who do a lot of business in China have become incredibly aware of their internet and computer security. They travel with hardened personal handhelds. They use encryption. They don't let their laptops out of their sight.
Wow.
If you are anybody that the Chinese might find interesting, particularly if you're a businessman or you're an engineer or you're engaged in high technology or a startup, if you've got trade secrets or industrial information that they're interested in, you have to be very, very careful indeed.
Today we're talking about the novel Night Heron, written by Adam Brooks, former BBC correspondent in China. So Philip Mangan, the British spy, has a relationship with the British embassy. And for all that we talk about the independent press and the free press, he has a relationship with a political officer in the embassy. And it raises the issue of the relationship that journalists must have or should have or might have with their embassies. How much fraternization is acceptable these days?
It just depends. People do things in people have different views about that. There are a lot of different views about it. It always pays for any journalist to be on good terms with the diplomats who know what's going on, just in terms of information, particularly if you're covering, say, you know, the U.S.-China relationship. You've got to talk to American diplomats about that relationship and what's happening with it. The degree to which you rely on diplomats as your source of information is perhaps a little more difficult to gauge. Reporters always feel slightly uncomfortable, I think, being too much in the pockets of the diplomats. You don't want to be seen as a reporter to be too close and too much in the pockets of the diplomats. But on the other hand, you know, they can be incredibly useful sources. And they can tell you a lot about what's going on. And in a country like China, where everybody is guessing quite a lot of the time, you do end up talking to the diplomats. In other countries where things are more open and more transparent, you rely on them much less.
So Eisenhower, back in the 50s, in the middle of the Cold War, referred to the military-industrial complex. You refer to the espionage-industrial complex, and it brings up the question of what is the role of intelligence gathering, and how does it change in an age where private industry is also gathering very sensitive information?
Yeah, and I mean, that's not my coinage. I didn't come up with that term, the espionage-industrial complex. That's already, it's being used by people who are monitoring this sort of explosive growth of private companies in intelligence gathering. You know, once upon a time, spying was the sole preserve of the state. It was one of the few things that sovereign states still did without any assistance from the outside. And that's now over. Private corporations provide, obviously, they provide the computers and the networks for American intelligence agencies and British intelligence agencies. They provide experts who go into the CIA and the NSA and all the other big agencies in the States to help them run their networks. They provide analysts. They provide all sorts of strategic advice. And to some degree, they now also, and it's very hard to know how far, but there are strong signs that private companies now provide personnel for the actual conduct of espionage operations too. So we're getting a strong sense that the intelligence community is now more and more dependent on private corporations to maintain its ability to gather intelligence. in much the same way that the U.S. military is now highly dependent on private contractors to run operations abroad as well. This shouldn't surprise us too much, but it does raise very interesting questions, and perhaps for many people, troubling questions, about the degree to which government and private intelligence companies have a conflict of interest, and to what degree our intelligence community is now so sort of in hock to private companies that, you know, could it actually function independently anymore? Or is it now entirely dependent on for-profit corporations contracting for it?
Given the 1984 atmosphere that you depict in this novel and everything we've been talking about, you've been talking about most for most of this interview, there's still some moments in your novel where you see Chinese taken off in different directions. And I refer to anti-regime graffiti and to one part in the novel where there is a revolutionary opera being performed in a politically subversive theater. Obviously, there's another underbelly to China that gets by with some things in spite of all of this.
China has loosened up a whole lot. It really has. I mean, by comparison to where it was when I first went in the early 1980s, when everybody was still wearing Mao suits and riding bicycles, the place is unrecognizable. And the degree to which you can speak in public and you can explore new kinds of speech and you can create dramatic, subversive art, music, video, film, all these things, all these arenas of expression have grown extraordinarily. And the party doesn't mind, the Communist Party doesn't mind as long as you don't cross certain lines. And they're quite sort of, they're reasonably clear about it. You don't criticize the party leadership by name, and you don't don't call for the overthrow of the Chinese Communist Party, and you don't, whatever you do, call for any form of ethnic separatism, particularly if you're a Chinese Muslim or you're a Tibetan. If you say anything which could subvert the territorial integrity of China and the Chinese state, you're going to be in big trouble mighty quickly. So there are certain areas that are still verboten, but there's an awful lot that you can do and say now in China. And it's led to this massive artistic renaissance.
Well, we've run out of time, but I have to ask the last and most important question as someone who really enjoyed this book. I understand there will be a sequel to Night Heron.
So I originally wrote it for there not to be a sequel, and I sort of wrote all the characters out at the end of Night Heron. And my editor at Little Brown in London informed me that actually there was going to be a sequel. So I had to rewrite the entire end of the book and bring all my characters back to life and leave them in such a way that you finish Night Heron feeling like you finished one story, but there's another story waiting to be told. That was my intention. And there will be a sequel to Night Heron coming out next summer, and the same characters and the same themes, most of the same characters anyway, and the same themes are being dealt with in that story. And in fact, there will then be a third one after that. I'm just coming to the end of the manuscript of the second, and I'm about to start writing the third. So it'll be a trilogy, I hope, if all goes according to plan.
Well, at least a trilogy is what I would expect, because I just think you've done a fantastic job. I say to everyone listening, this is a book where you really learn a lot about China, about diplomacy, about spying. And of course, Adam, you're the one that brings this all to life in a really thrilling novel. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for your very kind words, and thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Adam Brooks. Next week, Peter Finn, author of The Zhivago Affair, The Kremlin, The CIA, and The Battle Over a Forbidden Book. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.